Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Networks on Sunday, July 20th, 2014. This is episode 1102. Enjoy. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. Time to talk about tech, computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, all that jazz. It's going to be fun. About an hour and a half from now, we're talking to John Miller, who has taken a drone copter higher than any man ever before. He shot video drone footage of the Himalayas as part of his yearly Everest trek. That should be fun. But right now, we can talk about anything on your mind, whether it's, the latest net neutrality regulations, Facebook privacy, which phone to buy, the big hacker. Big is not so big. It's a jewel of a hacker convention called HOPE, Hackers on Planet Earth, going on in New York City this week. And a very interesting presentation at HOPE by a forensics guy who, is an expert on security and smartphone security and all that jazz. And we had talked before, I'd been talking for some time about how well done the iPhone security is and how much Apple regards your privacy and how carefully they protect it. And then along comes Jay-Z Zalarsky. I'm sorry, Jonathan. And a presentation at this hacker convention about all the holes in the iPhone, about all the security flaws in the iPhone. It's kind of scary, including what we technologists call a packet sniffer that's running all the time. Apple hasn't responded yet, but it's kind of, I guess it's important to underscore the fact that when you're using any device where, you know, other independent parties haven't vetted the software, there's always the risk that the software, it intentionally or unintentionally, reveals stuff to an interested party, such as federal law enforcement or hackers. In this case, it's kind of hard to tell what Apple's intention was. They have running on the phone, not in the developer mode, but just all the time, something that allows somebody to see what's going on your network. And Zalarsky, I'm sorry, Jonathan, Zalarsky revealed some of the data that is constantly leaked out by the iPhone to anybody who's interested. And I guess it's good to know. It's good to know. There's a long post on his blog about this. He put up the PowerPoint slides in a PDF, identifying backdoors, attack points, and surveillance mechanisms on iOS devices. For those who are really interested in the deep dive on this, I'll put a link to that in the show notes. But the top line is, don't assume, basically every phone you carry is constantly monitoring your location, whether you're upright or seated, lying down, facing north. It's got a microphone in it. It's got a camera in it. And while we kind of assume that somehow Android is more vulnerable than iOS, it turns out iOS is just as, if not even more, vulnerable, and that your iPhone is just as much a device broadcasting all sorts of information about you to interested parties as anything else. Yeah, I guess it shouldn't be much of a surprise to anybody. It kind of discourages you, though, doesn't it? When you think, well, Facebook knows everything about me because I give them everything. Google seems to know everything about me because every time I use Google, it keeps track of that. And I use Google, in a lot of different situations, not just for search. My smartphone knows everything about me. Apparently, it's available to anybody. I guess if you want to be private, just disconnect is about the only choice. Oh, don't use a credit card. Isn't that, we talk about that in the Breaking Bad. Remember when he's trying to, Bryan Cranston's trying to hide? They put him up in, I don't know, Alaska somewhere with no power, no internet, nothing. He's got a wood stove and they bring him food every 3 months. That's about it. That may be where some Microsoft employees are moving. 18,000 Microsoft employees, the largest ever, will be laid off. Now, that's the headline that goes, oy, yi, yi. That's 14% of its staff. It's the biggest layoff in Microsoft's history. But many of those people, 12,500, the majority of those people, are people who came on board when Microsoft bought Nokia. So they're extra people. And most of them are not in the U.S. Most of them are in Nokia's home country of Finland. So it's not like Microsoft's suffering. Well, maybe it's suffering a little bit. But it's just, this is a realignment, as they say, of staff. I think that's exactly the phrase Satya Nadella, the CEO, used. It's going to cost him $1.1 to $1.6 billion related to severance and benefits. The 13,000 jobs cut immediately. Another 5,000 will be cut over the next 6 months. And a total of 1,351 jobs in the Seattle region, the headquarters region for Microsoft. That's about 3%. We expected this. Nokia had something like 25,000 employees in manufacturing, design, in Finland and around the world. And many of them were unneeded by Microsoft. And the good news is Nokia is still making the tires. They're still making the rubber boots. So maybe those workers can go over to the rubber boots side of the business. You hate hearing about layoffs, though, at these tough times because you just know how hard it is to get a job. Man, it's tough. So well, good luck to those Microsoft employees. And I think Microsoft's going to be pretty generous with the severance packages and so forth. That's why it's going to cost them more than $1 billion. A lot of money. Netflix is testing a private viewing mode. You know, speaking of privacy, for a long time we've... Remember when you used to... Do you remember going to the video store and running a cassette? Even in those days, federal and local law enforcement could go to the video store and say, yeah, we'd like to subpoena Leo Laporte's viewing habits, see if we can learn anything about him from that. And they were able to do it. In fact, in more recent times, thanks to the Patriot Act, they could do it and compel the video store not to tell anyone or the library or the grocery store, anybody they asked for this kind of information from. Has he been buying hummus? And don't tell anybody we asked. So we don't know the degree to which that's going on. But Netflix, of course, mostly now is streaming video. They've added, I think this is a good idea, a private viewing mode in Netflix. Now, it's tested, so don't look for it. It may not be on your Netflix yet. But here's what will happen. If you choose privacy mode during viewing, it will not appear in your viewing activity log. It will not be used to determine recommendations about what you should watch. So has it ever happened where you watch a movie? It's happened to me. That maybe you shouldn't have been watching, but you watch it. And now all the recommendations. Let me put it this way. Netflix thinks I'm gay. I'm just gonna put it that way. Okay? Don't need to go any farther. But all the recommendations change. Now with private viewing mode, you can watch. You can have that binge of B-movies, the Roadhouse flicks, and would not be penalized in future Netflix recommendations. You can watch, as somebody in the chat room said, you can watch My Little Pony and not worry. You know, that's actually, you're joking about that. But my little stepson is in sixth grade. And don't tell anybody, but he likes My Little Pony. But it's very embarrassing to him because if any of the other sixth grade boys knew, they would tease him mercilessly. Apparently, it's not unusual, though, that because people like My Little Pony, but they don't want to admit it. Well, now I'm going to out myself. Yes, I like My Little Pony too. It's cute fun. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number. I've been outed by Netflix. 888-827-5536. Let's talk tech. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Little did I know, and I've been informed now, Heather Hammond, the phone ranger, tells me that, in fact, it's not unusual for adult men to like My Little Pony. There's a whole movement called the Brony Movement and a documentary about bronies. So this is not, I'm not alone.
You know, so little surprises me. But this was definitely one of those.
That surprises me.
Then.
But there are, Comic-Con in San Diego going on and coming up, I guess, this week. And I think there'll be a lot of people wearing their little ponytails at Comic-Con.
Is it too late for us to get tickets and convert and head on down?
I'm a brony.
Saddle up, bronies.
Wow. Well, I guess there's no reason for Netflix then to hide your obsession with My Little Pony, because it's okay. It's good. We live in a tolerant world, tolerant society. So Heather has been lining up the phone calls for the show, and I'm glad to talk to anybody about anything, even My Little Pony. Who should we start with, though?
Well, I am in love with this first caller, Rod in Hemet.
Rod will be happy to hear that. Hi, Rod. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. Thanks for taking my call, man.
My pleasure. What can I do for you, sir?
Well, I'm 53. I'm a truck driver, and I got to get out of that business, and I want to go into the tech business, and I really wanted your opinion on what area of technology should I get into, what is in greatest demand. I'm pretty much an open book. I can learn and do anything. I'm very mechanical, but, you know, I think I could fit into this industry, but where? And then my second part, how would I go about it? Should I take additional schooling, or should I do it online? You know, those kinds of things.
Well, a lot of this is going to depend a little bit on you and your interests. I mean, I always think that it's a good idea to keep in mind what there's a market for, but it's also important to pick something you really are good at and really like. Because even if there isn't a vast mass market for something, if you happen to be particularly good at it, you can make the market, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So obviously, if you're listening to this show, you're somewhat interested in technology. Is there a particular part of it that I'll give you an example. Some people can write computer software. And if you're coming out, especially if you're young, I don't know if it's good for us older folks, but if you're coming out of school right now as a computer science graduate, you're clearly looking at, maybe I should start a business, maybe I should do my own app development, right? You see people like WhatsApp getting $16 billion for an app, and you think, wow, there's gold in them nar heels. But that's not for everyone, for a couple of reasons. First of all, most people don't make a lot of money. It's a little bit of a gamble. You know, you're kind of putting all your money on red, or maybe even better, double zero. It's also requires certain skills, certain abilities. You can learn to program, but that doesn't mean you have an aptitude for it. Yeah. If you're saying, a lot of people do very well in IT services, a variety of IT services. That's more of a customer support business than anything else. If you're good with people, that would certainly be good. But then there's also the guy who has to crawl around and pull cables and wire stuff up. If you're mechanically minded and very good at that, networking is a great skill to have if you can set up a network. And you don't need to be, unless you're running your own business, you don't need to be as people focused. A lot of geeks shouldn't be in the people business.
Yeah.
You know, I'm one of them.
Right.
You just, if you're a public facing business, it's a different challenge than if you're, crawling around in the basement, wiring it up the network. Now, as for tech schools, that is also true, that your personality, if you're the kind of person who can learn on his own, there's great learning materials, free and paid online. A tech school going somewhere like, DeVry is very expensive.
Right.
Very expensive. It's like college. And, there have been a number of investigations lately of schools that have promised, we'll get you a job and don't, and so forth. So, you know, I still think you're on your own no matter what. And there's no magic bullet there with the schools. You can go to the library, the bookstore, or go online and get materials and learn on your own. If you're good at that, I think you can learn everything you need, especially if you have an aptitude for it. For some people, you know, especially because you can get student loans and everything, you can go out and go to a school and get some loans and get a good education and then get a certificate. So a lot of times, if you're trying to get a job in the tech business, what you're looking for is some way of proving not having had the experience that you can do the job. And for that, we have these certification programs. And there's quite a few of them. There's Microsoft, Cisco. There's the A-plus certification, which shows you know IT. We have a sponsor of our podcast I will absolutely recommend heartily because it's affordable, but it gives you great training. It's called IT Pro TV. It's at itpro.tv. They do online, basically you could watch it on your Roku or your computer classes and learn that way. And there are quite a few of those, too. That's much more affordable than going to a school. But it really depends on you and what your aptitude, your ability, and your interests are. The other thing you might be interested in, if you come from a business, as you do coming from trucking, if you come from a business where you know intimately how that business works, don't throw that out. Maybe that could be useful. Somebody in the chat room says, make an app that's in the trucking arena. Yeah. Actually, you know what truckers might need or want. Having that special knowledge is valuable because a lot of people have the knowledge of how to write software, but they don't have the knowledge about where that software is going in the business and stuff. So there's a lot of different avenues to pursue. Follow your heart. You know, even at 53, follow your heart. But it's a good idea to follow it with clear eyes and some knowledge about where the marketplace is going. We, you know, everything in business nowadays, technology is it. And if you understand technology, you know how to wire a network, you know how to set up a PC, you know how to support customers or hold their hands as they go through the trying times of learning how to use Microsoft Excel, there's a market. You bet. There's definitely a market. And I think it's an exciting field because it's constantly moving, constantly changing. That's the other thing. And maybe why young people are particularly good at this. It changes constantly. They grew up with it, but as we get older, I think less and less open to change. I noticed that myself. And that's one of the things that is a constant change in the tech business. It's going to move and move and move. We thought it was PCs for a while, right? Then it became laptops. Then it became tablets. Now it's smartphones. And who knows what it'll be next month? Maybe watches. I don't know. And you got to be willing to move with the times. Hey, good luck, though. I think it's a great field to be in. I love it. I chose it. You know, I was a radio broadcaster for years, and I on the side as a hobby, I pursued technology and wrote for magazines and learned how to use it. And it's been very good for me. Not been bad at all. Thanks for the call, Rod, and good luck, Ed. Redondo Beach, California. We're going to have a minute, and then we'll have to take a break. But maybe you can... Oh, I guess, Ed, you're just going to have to hang on for a second.
Okay.
All right, right after the commercial. We'll be back with more. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. Right before the break, I picked up the phone and said, hi, Ed, and then put him on hold again. Hi, Ed. Let's try again from Redondo Beach. Welcome.
Hello, Leo. Can you hear me?
I hear you great. Thanks.
Okay, great. Thank you. I have an HTC One smartphone.
Love it.
And it's, me too. It's not the new one, but
the original one, yeah.
Yeah, it serves my needs well.
Yeah, no, it's great.
And but recently, it's sort of been thinking for itself. And I'm not sure what's going on.
Yesterday somebody called and said my HTC One has been rebooting spontaneously just over and over and over again. What's yours doing?
One thing it did that bothered me was the weather aspect of it, AccuWeather.
Yeah.
I have seven cities, and one of which is where I live. The one in which the Redondo one got switched out for another city, and it won't let me put it back in.
Okay.
The one I need the most?
Yeah. Well, there is a setting. I'm not sure which weather app you're using. There is a setting that says the current location, and presumably your Redondo, when you had Redondo on there, it was because that was your current location. Maybe the GPS is turned off or stopped working, location services.
Oh, okay. So that might be it. All right.
Yeah. Let's check that anyway. Make sure your location services is on.
Another aberration was it just sort of spontaneously moved the icon for voice recorder to the last page of the icons, which is where the weather and YouTube are by themselves. So now it's those two and the voice recorder.
Well, you know you can move those icons around, right?
Right, but I mean, so that's no big deal if it does it on its own.
Just drag it back to where it was. It's easy by accident to do, and I'm not saying this is what happened, but there's a launcher, you know, and Android phones, one of the nice things about the Android phone in general is you can use third-party launchers. You don't have to use the HTC, they call it Blinkfeed, their launcher. You can use other launchers. I like Nova Launcher, Apex, and ADW. These are all third-party launchers that have some nice features. However, if you're in your Blink feed, it's moved around. You can press it, hold it, and drag it to somewhere else. But one of the reasons I like Apex, Nova, and ADW is you can lock your desktop and say, don't move, unless I explicitly say it, don't move icons anymore. And then you have to unlock the desktop before you can rearrange icons. And since I'm always accidentally dragging icons around, just, you know, not paying attention, and I keep my finger on there too long. And
yeah, I'm sure I've done that.
That's probably what's happened, yeah.
My last complaint was that the clock icon automatically or mysteriously appeared on the desktop. And I use it a lot for, like,
It's probably the same thing.
Okay.
Probably the same thing. It's easy, you know, you open your app drawer, you press and hold the clock, and if you hold it too long, you can accidentally drag it to the desktop. Okay. Doesn't sound like anything's too weird. These are all little things that happen. You might get a better weather app. The AccuWeather's okay. I like Yahoo Weather. You might try that.
I'll try that.
That will let you do both. Explicitly add Redondo Beach and have it give you the weather in a current location. I do that because I travel. So I have Petaluma as a separate page where we live.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a way, Petaluma shows up twice because it shows the current weather in Petaluma. But then when I'm in Hawaii, the current weather is where I am, and I still see a Petaluma page. So
all right.
I think all of these things are not abnormal. You shouldn't jump to any conclusions yet.
All right. I'm not that tech savvy, so I was a little...
Yeah. This is, in a way, this is one of the problems with Android, is it's very customizable. And so maybe what you just described, all of those things could happen on an iPhone, too. Apple tries harder, though, to keep you from having weird things happen. Getting used to an Android phone, to some degree, is like getting used to a Windows computer, you know? And if you've ever had a Windows computer, you know, strange things happen. How did that icon get there? And it's not really that the computer has a mind of its own. It's, you know, just inadvertently. I've had people call me up and say, my taskbar is at the top of the screen instead of the bottom. Well, yeah, because you accidentally dragged it up there. You probably didn't even notice it when you did it. Apple doesn't allow you to move things around like that. And they try to protect you from yourself a little bit more. But good luck with that, Ed. I think nothing to worry about at this point. It's not haunted anyway. Annette, Tustin, California. Leo LaPorte, the tech guy. Hi, Annette.
Hi, Leo. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thanks for calling. What can I do for you?
I recently purchased a Dell desktop PC running Windows 7, and I have it set up to do automatic updates.
Good.
So when I shut the computer off, it says installing 9 updates.
Yep.
Shuts itself off.
Yep.
When I boot it back up, it says it failed configuring the Windows updates, reverting changes.
I hate it when that happens.
And it's doing it for like 2 weeks now.
Yeah, once it fails at an update, it will keep trying, and you'll keep getting that message until it succeeds, which means you may get that for the rest of your life. And there's two things to say about that. One, it's very important you apply that update when it's available. Every second Tuesday of the month, which means now almost 2 weeks ago, Microsoft pushes out critical updates. These are the ones that get applied automatically. They're usually security patches. Really important. So let's not let this continue. It's so common. Microsoft has a troubleshooting page for what to do when Windows Update fails to update.
Okay.
So if you just search for Microsoft and failed Windows Update, make sure you go to the page that is at support.microsoft.com.
Okay.
And you'll find a whole thing, Windows Update Automated Troubleshooter. You'll have step by step for every version of Windows, a lot of different pages, troubleshoot common problems. And the reason is, this is a hard thing to do. Updating an operating system while it's running, it's kind of like not only pulling the tablecloth out from under all the table settings, but then putting a new one in.
Okay.
It works most of the time, to Microsoft's credit, but when it fails, it's bad news because it's stuck. It means also that the next second Tuesday of the month, you won't get any updates because it still hasn't applied last ones.
Right. So I thought I could go to the update page and maybe install the updates one at a time. Would that help?
You can. Generally, what's happened is it's stuck, and that won't fix it. You need to undo. So if you go to this, and we'll put a link in the show notes to the Windows Updates Issues page. There's a Fix It For Me that goes into the registry and says that this is not the update you're looking for. You never saw this update. This update doesn't exist. And then it tries again. If it fails again, then you might want to do that. So Microsoft offers manual versions of these updates, chiefly for businesses where the IT department wants to install the updates on all the machines at once. So the IT guy puts it on a thumb drive and walks around. So you can do that. It's a little tricky. You know, you have to go into the Windows update page, and then you have to go to network updates, and it's kind of complicated, but you can do that. And that might be a good solution. It's probably something fixable, and this update page will probably do it for you.
Because the other thing is I tried to create a system repair disk a while ago, and it won't do that either. So I'm a little worried. I have a Windows 7 install disk.
Good. That's all you need.
That's all I need.
Yeah.
System repair disk.
Yeah. The system repair disk is because Microsoft charges less for Windows to a like Dell or HP or Toshiba if they don't give you a disk. Because Microsoft's so paranoid, has always been paranoid about piracy.
Okay.
That they don't want people to have disks. But you know what? This disk often fails. Which means you're really up a creek because you don't have a boot disk. So right. I'm glad. If you have a Windows 7 install disk, that's the main thing you need. That's all
okay.
You need. Yeah.
Because I contacted Dell and said, I can't make a repair disk. And they said, well, boot off the install disk and then make a repair disk. And I thought, well, is that really worth the effort?
Well, if you got some time when you have a few hours to kill, you're okay. Watching a Matlock, you know, a marathon or something, then maybe you want to do that. But the main thing you have, which is the most important thing, which is the Windows 7 install disk. Everybody needs one of those. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Little tribute to James Garner. Passed away at the age of 86 today. Everybody just loved James Garner. Remember he did those Polaroid ads? Remember those?
I do.
With a woman who everybody assumed they were a couple because they just bickered so well together.
They had chemistry. Marriott Hartley? No. Who was it? Shoot. Get the Google machine out.
I think we're going to have... It's too bad there... I love this joke, and everybody tells it so often, but I have to say it again. Too bad there's no way to find out who that was. James Garner did the Polaroid commercial. It'd be so neat, wouldn't it, if there were just some way
somebody
you could take out your phone...
A thing. It's like the encyclopedia, but better, and it's online.
It is, in fact, Marriott Hartley.
Oh, I win.
You win.
No, it's the time 01.
You win.
And here's the world's fastest developing color. You see it in seconds now, not minutes.
Look at that color.
You felt like they were married.
It comes with a pack of Time Zero.
But they, in fact, didn't. They'd never met before.
Certainly are made for each other.
Just like coffee and cream.
Do you think that they got together after?
I don't know. That's what. Polaroid. Whatever happened to Polaroid? Forget Marriott Hartley and James Garner.
That makes me want one of those again.
Meet the Swinger, Polaroid Swinger. Remember that?
No.
Swing it up, yeah, yeah. Take a shot, yeah, yeah.
I have a Polaroid app on my phone, though, called Shake It. And
it's a different,
fun.
Yeah, you take a picture and then you have to shake it to develop?
Shake it like a Polaroid
That's
picture.
Pretty funny. No, they don't. Polaroid sold the name to another company, which has been using its name in vain. Let me see if I can find these Swinger commercials, as long as we're talking about it. There it is, yeah. I love this. Very 60s.
Oh, nice.
I guess it was called a swinger because you had a strap around your wrist with the camera on it. Look at the size of that thing. Good price, though, $19.95. Wait 3 minutes. It'll develop itself. No point in shaking it. It doesn't help.
God, I love that. They just make it so sexy to just walk around with your camera swinging from your wrist.
So I'm trying to find what era that was. It looked like 60s, huh?
Yeah, and the music was very, you know.
Yeah, yeah, $19.95.
They really committed to that price with putting the price, the
What they don't tell you is like $3 for the cartridge.
Right.
That's where they made all the money.
That's where they get you.
It is also, as long as we're talking about ancient history, 45 years ago on this day that Neil Armstrong first walked on the moon.
Yay.
And I mentioned this yesterday, but I'll mention again, NASA TV tonight, 10:30 p.m., will rebroadcast the video. We all, some of us, old of certain age, got up. I remember getting up to watch in my jammies. I was 13. And watch the very grainy black and white pictures of Neil Armstrong stepping on the moon, first human on the moon. And so they're going to, apparently they've reconditioned the video. And it's crisp and clear and high def.
I can't wait.
I know. I'm going to stay up late tonight. I'll be in my jammies once again. Everything old is new again. Yeah. I have the footy jammies that I was wearing at the age of 13.
They stretch.
Okay. really pretty exciting. Pretty exciting. And I think part of it, you know, if you follow all of this, Buzz Aldrin, Neil Armstrong, Chris, has passed away. Buzz Aldrin, who's the second man on the moon, still with us, very active. In fact, he's on Google Plus and been very active in celebrating the 45th anniversary of his walk on the moon. There's lots of stuff to talk about. I interviewed Buzz many years ago, have an autograph, which I cherish, on one of his books. Really, really great guy. All right, let's say hi now to Kim in Santa Clarita, our next caller. Hi, Kim. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. I am with one of the cell phone companies that doesn't have contracts anymore, and I'm thinking about switching over to an iPhone. Wanted to know where the best price I could find one.
So you're with somebody like Virgin Mobile or Wireless, Republic Wireless, or something like
T-Mobile,
that?
T-Mobile, yeah.
T-Mobile has iPhones.
They do.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I was going to suggest T-Mobile. I love T-Mobile because they have this whole Un-carrier thing where you go month to month. Now, understand, if you don't have a contract, you're not going to get a subsidized price. But a subsidized price is smoke and mirrors anyway. You still pay for the phone. You just pay for it over the 2 years of your contract. So what T-Mobile said is, look, you know, we'll stretch those payments out just as we would if you were under contract. You could pay month to month, you know, but you know what you're paying. You know you're paying for the phone. You know they've taken the $700. But, you know, it's a steep cost for an iPhone. But we've taken it, we've stretched it out so that it feels like you're the same thing. And they're being very clear about that. I love T-Mobile. Are you getting good service? This is the only negative. Their coverage map isn't maybe as complete as something like Verizon.
Well, I'm getting really great service, but the problem is I think everybody's starting to get less and less service. And the nice thing with iPhone is if you travel or out of area, you can do the iMessage. And you don't really need service for those.
Yeah, that just uses the internet. That's right.
Right. And so my whole family has iPhones, and it's kind of one of those things to switch over for that reason. If you're ever out of an area, then you're able to still send those messages back and forth.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Although you can do that if you can encourage your family. The problem I have with messages is that it's Apple only.
Right.
And so if you have somebody with Android, they'll have to use SMS anyway. So there are, and this is one of the reasons Facebook paid $16 billion for WhatsApp. They do the same thing, but they run on every phone. So if you can convince your family to start using something like WhatsApp, you get all those benefits without having to be Apple specific. Nevertheless, they have the iPhone 5S at T-Mobile, zero down, $27 a month for 2 years. It's the same kind of thing, but there's no contract. You just understand that you're paying for this phone and you're stretching the payments out over 2 years.
And that was my question, is I'm willing to pay the outright.
They'll sell it to you that way too. You can even go to the Apple store and buy it. There's no discount on an iPhone.
Oh, okay.
iPhone, and in fact, Apple's very tight on pricing. So you can't usually get a better deal. Maybe you can get $5 off. You can't usually get a much better deal anywhere else. Apple store is fine. T-Mobile's fine. It's the same exact phone. The advantage of going T-Mobile is they'll take your SIM out of your old phone. They'll put it in the new iPhone. They'll make sure everything's all set up. But it's the same. It's exactly the same.
So then the last question would be, is it better to wait until the iPhone 6 comes out to buy a later version?
If you can wait the 2 months, because it'll be September,
okay,
then I would. only because it is going to be better. In fact, Apple does this TikTok thing where they don't change the design every 2 years. So the current iPhone 5S is the same design as the iPhone 5. They added a thumbprint reader and that kind of thing. But it's the same shape, and the new one will look different. It'll be bigger. Bigger, we believe. Again, these, you know, it's all speculation. Apple doesn't say it. Almost certainly, it'll be out in the fall. They'll announce it in September. Usually, it's out within a week or so of the announcement. We've heard from the supply chain in China that they're already making them. We've seen cases. We've seen covers that purport to be the new iPhone. And it's 4.7 inches. Beautiful looking. If you can wait 2 months, I'd wait 2 months.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy, 8888 Ask Leo, the website, techguylabs.com. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. It's time to talk computers and the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, anything with a chip in it. Phone number 8888-ASK-LEO, 888-827-5536. That's toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. You can also call from other areas just by using Skype out. Toll free call, you know, won't cost you anything. You can also visit our website. Great place to go. Get the information on the phone numbers, get the chat room link. It's techguylabs.com, and of course, every show is on there. This is show 1102. We put up the audio and video after the fact, but also text with the questions. We break it up by question, by hour, by day. Questions, my answers, and your comments. If you have something to say, if you listen to Leo and he says something stupid, you just write it there in the comment. You can add it to the value of the page. No charge, no subscription cost. You don't have to sign up for anything. You know, we don't want your email address. You can keep it. Thank you. TechGuyLabs.com. Now, Barry's on the line, our next caller from Aliso Viejo, California. Hi, Barry.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, Leo.
That's great. Great to talk to you. What can I do for you?
Thank you. I just wanted to mention that the young woman who is screening your calls is very friendly. And reassuring that she sounds like a lovely woman.
She is, and if somebody doesn't snap her up quick, she's a keeper, boys.
So she's not taken?
She's actually crying. No, but her boyfriend's listening. I'm making sure he understands what he's got there. What can I? Don't start macking on Heather, okay? What can I do for you, Barry? Oh, he's not interested anymore. He says, I'm through. She's taken. Oh, no. Go ahead. Okay. Yes. What can I do for you? I'm sorry. I'm just teasing Heather at this point.
She's... My office is in the basement of a commercial building.
Yeah.
And there's a window. And I'm really having trouble with reception, drop calls, and quality.
Sure.
I heard you talk about some of the Wilson Electric.
Yes.
And I've looked into them, but they all seem to require a window, which I don't have.
Well, what they require, so the way the Wilsons work, and there are a number of these cell phone repeaters, I happen to like the Wilsons the best. Disclaimer, I think they were a sponsor for a while. The way the Wilsons work is you have to have somewhere where you do get reception. Because basically, you put an antenna where you do get reception, and then you're going to put the Wilson repeater somewhere where you don't, like your office, and it, in effect, puts a cell phone tower in your office. Now, I've seen this used. The first place I saw a Wilson used was at my local independent cell phone store. The guy moved. I felt bad for Damien. He moved to a nicer location, but I don't know why he did this. He should have checked. There was no cell phone service. He's trying to sell cell phones, and there's no service. But fortunately, at the front of the store, he could put an antenna because there was service, you know, out the door, and then it would go all to the way. It was just, I guess it was a deep store. So it's a similar situation. If you can figure out a way to run a wire to somewhere where there is reception, maybe the floor above you, then Wilson would be a good solution. If that is not an option, then there's another way to do it that the cell phone companies actually will help you with. The technical term for them is called femtocells, F-E-M-T-O. What they are is little tiny, basically cell towers that use your internet connection to get on the network. So AT&T and others, they call them microcells. If you say, look, I'm going to cancel service because it doesn't work in my office, They may suggest this. They may even put one in for free for you. Usually they charge you for it. It does require internet access. But then you'll get 5 bars. And all of your traffic, it looks to the cell phone like it's on a boot on a cell phone tower. But really what it is on this femto cell, which is then using the internet to send the traffic to AT&T or whoever. So they're not expensive. They're a couple hundred bucks. It's certainly for somebody in your situation, it may be that's the only solution, because it may not just be that particular carrier. You could try other carriers if you're lucky and there's somebody with a tower really near your office and they're blasting in. It might get through the concrete. That's what's blocking it. You probably, you're in the basement. You probably concrete with, the worst case would be concrete with rebar. Metal blocks these signals. So, there's something called a Faraday cage, named after Michael Faraday, who was the discoverer of electromagnetism. It's a copper mesh cage. You put something in a Faraday cage, no radio signals get in or out. You can see through it. Light gets in and out, but not radio signals. You're, in effect, in a Faraday cage in many cases because there's rebar in the concrete. That's, in effect, a metal mesh. And so a window's nice because glass doesn't block these. But you don't have to have a window. You have to have something that's not blocking the traffic. In this case, it sounds like because you're in the basement, that's the problem. And then there are carriers like T-Mobile, as somebody in the chat room is pointing out, that will do Wi-Fi on the phones. I don't like Wi-Fi calling. I found it not to work too well. You know who does it well is Republic Wireless. They actually are a very inexpensive carrier. I think they run over the Sprint network. Because one of the reasons they're so inexpensive is it'll use Wi-Fi. The phone will use Wi-Fi whenever it can to make phone calls. And they seem to do the handoff quite well. I actually did a test. I had a Republic Wireless call, started making a call in my home over the Wi-Fi, got in the car during the call, drove away, breaking the Wi-Fi signal, moving over to the Sprint cell phone signal, and it did it seamlessly, which is the first time I've ever had that experience. So there are some people who can do that. Drill a hole in the wall. Yeah, somebody say, drill a hole in the wall. Run the Wilson Wireless antenna through the if you can get to the outside anyway, the Wilson will work in some form or fashion. Otherwise, get a femto cell or a micro cell, as they sometimes call them. Hey, Eddie's on the line from El Monte, California. Hi, Eddie.
Hi, Leo. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
What is your opinion on the LG G3, and if there's a better phone out right now, or should I wait a few months for something better?
I haven't played with it yet. I've only been reading about it. I have tried all of the LG G2 and the Flex before, and I think they're great phones. There's one weird thing about it. So let me tell you what's cool about the G3, and I'll tell you what's not so cool. It is, of course, a state-of-the-art phone. It's LG's latest. Just came out. Verizon's going to offer it in the next week or so. It has the highest resolution screen on the market today. It's a big screen, 5-plus inches, but it also is ultra-high def. It is a 4K screen. Now, I don't think you can tell the difference between that and a high-def screen on a screen that size, but maybe there's some magic that makes it look even better. It certainly is. There's no point in going beyond that. It's as crisp as a screen needs to be. Perfect crispness. That will impact the battery life a little bit. Fortunately, this is the first LG G phone which you can replace the battery. It has a replaceable battery. That's a good thing. Reviewers are saying it's getting decent battery life. That's good news. So in every other respect, it's a very competent Android phone. I think the G3 is a state-of-the-art, top-of-the-line smartphone. The only weird thing about it, and some people it bothers, some people it doesn't, the buttons are not on the side, they're on the back. LG says that's because when you're holding the phone to your ear, you can easily turn up the volume because your finger's right there. It's right next to the camera. I find that an odd placement. I'm not crazy about it, but that's maybe because I use a lot of different phones, and so it throws me a little bit. I'm used to the volume and the on-off switch being on the sides of the phone.
Now, is there a phone that will be coming out in a few months with a similar display size?
They're the first and the only one I know of, although now, LG makes those screens, so they can dominate for a little bit anyway. But, whenever – you've seen this over and over again. Whenever a new smartphone with advanced specs, faster processor or whatever comes out, it's only for a month or two that they own it. And then all of a sudden everybody else is using the same screen. I think that the UHD screen is a gimmick. I don't think you need, at 5.5 inches, why do you need 2560 by 1440? It's more resolution than your eye can see. But for right now, they own that market. It's a good gimmick. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Celebrating National Ice Cream Day. I thought every day was National Ice Cream Day. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, coming up in about 10 minutes. We're going to talk to John Miller. He is a great photographer and a fan of Mount Everest. And he goes up, I think, every year with our friend Chris Marquardt to do a photo expedition up there. His website is therestofeverest.com. And he did something this time a little different. He took a quadcopter up and attached a GoPro camera to it and shot video that some say is the highest video ever shot by a drone and a quadcopter. And that's pretty cool. So we're going to talk to him about the technology of quadcopters, shooting video from a quadcopter, and in particular shooting ultra-high-altitude video from a quadcopter. So John Miller will fill in for Chris Marquardt in about 10 minutes, our photo guy. 8888-ASK. Leo, that's the number. Linda's next in Santa Monica, California. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Leo. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I just want an opinion. I almost signed up for the AT&T UVerse Internet, the pro plan, the introductory for $29.99. And then I was doing some research online comparing other Internet plans. And so I canceled it and went with the Comcast Xfinity for $19.99 for introductory for a year.
Understand they're all teaser prices that will go up after a year.
Well, no, I realize that. Yeah. Then you can, and then I to save the $8 rental, I bought on Amazon a $67 modem.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, so with the. The UVerse, it would have cost me about $35 total, and now this is going to cost me maybe about $25. So I'm thinking, what do you think? Do you think I made the right decision?
I do. I made the same decision. In general, we are stuck in this country. We're very limited in our internet choices. 80%,
really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oddly enough, you'd think we'd have the best internet in the world. Not even close. 80% of U.S. Residents have only two choices, your cable company or your phone company. And the FCC really set it up that way. They gave both companies monopolies, and they are the companies that own the fast access into your house, the big fat pipes, the cable or the twisted copper that the phone company uses. Now, the phone company uses a technology called DSL, which isn't – and by the way – the FCC did open the phone company's lines so that there are often other people who can run over the phone company's wires, like DSL Extreme, our sponsor, and others. Mm-hmm. They're sometimes a better choice, but the company that owns the lines, in your case AT&T, really make it hard for these third parties. They have to legally offer them access, but they don't want them to be competing with them. I mean, they put the lines in. They feel like we ought to be using those lines exclusively. FCC never required that of the cable companies. So you'll notice the only company that can use your cable is your cable company, Comcast, in your case.
I also wanted to ask.
Comcast, by the way, cable in general, all other things being equal, is the fastest service.
That's what my my techie nephew was.
In general, it's preferable
to the Comcast because they're both 3 Mbps.
And yeah, because you're getting the cheapest service, so the speeds are going to be limited. Comcast knows that you're going to very quickly tire of 3 megabits, and they're going to give you faster service. Both Comcast and UVerse can give you faster service, but at some point UVerse will top out, depending on how far you are from the phone office. They'll top out, and Comcast will keep on going. You can, generally on a cable line, you can get 100 megabits down. So you can get faster, but you'll pay for it.
But you think I made the right decision?
I think so. I mean, Comcast is a nightmare to work with. They're the worst company in America. You've probably heard the Comcast cancellation call that's been going around my friends Ryan Block and Veronica Belmont made from earlier this week. It's just a nightmare to talk to Comcast.
Yeah.
But if you can put up with their service reps, I think they probably do give you better service. You know, you have to ask around. It's variable. In some areas, a cable company will come and go. You know, the connection will drop a lot. In that case, I would say get a DSL line. And if you're far from the phone office, a DSL line will be slower. Cable, it doesn't matter how far you are. If you have cable, you'll have full speed. So yeah. They're variables that are distinct to your area that I don't know about. But in general, cable is a little faster.
Yeah, that's what I've been reading in the chat rooms and everything.
It's just a shame that we have to deal with Comcast.
Yeah. Well, I hope I didn't make the right phone.
Hey, you know what? AT&T's no better. So the problem is these companies are monopolies. They don't have to treat their customers well. Where are you going to go?
And where's the competition?
If we had competition,
$10 a month. I mean, this is ridiculous. It should be even free.
The single biggest reason for having the very poor internet compared to most other developed nations is there's no competition. It's bad in Australia too, where the government owned the phone companies for a long time. Where companies have monopolies, there's no incentive to compete on price. There's no incentive to compete on service. So they give you a expensive internet with really terrible service. You get the worst of both worlds, and all we need is competition. But of course, at this point, it's almost too late. I feel like these companies are so big, so powerful, and now Comcast wants to merge with Time Warner, which would make it easily. It's already the biggest internet service provider in the country, along with the biggest cable company. It will make them much bigger. And you know what Comcast tells Congress when Congress says, "Well, why should we allow you to grow?" Hey. No, but we don't compete with Time Warner. They're in completely different markets. There's no competition with Time Warner. So it's really not going to change the competitive landscape. Yes, because they already have a monopoly. It can't get any worse. It could get worse. Believe me, it will get worse. And it's just really a shame. So as a customer, you're stuck. You don't have many choices. Both choices are with kind of big monopolies who don't care about you in the least. Unfortunately, the best service is probably provided by your local cable company, and you know, all other things being equal in most cases. And in general, these cable companies, and it's not just Comcast, all of them offer terrible service. Ever since we've been talking about this Comcast customer service call, which has been making the rounds, just search for Comcast customer service call. You'll find it. You can listen. It's the most painful 19 minutes of your life. Just horrible service. But after publicizing this, I've heard from a lot of Comcast reps anonymously, people who used to work for Comcast and currently do, and they say, really, you know, don't blame the rep. Comcast incents reps to be, absolutely annoying because they want a short call. They want to get you off the phone. They don't want you ever to cancel. It costs them in their pocketbook. These reps get paid less if you cancel. And they are also struggling with some of the worst software. Their infrastructure is terrible. He said, one of these guys said, I had to reboot frequently in customer calls. I'd have to reboot the computers. But the last thing we're allowed to do is tell the customer, oh, there's something wrong with our computer. So they'll stall you. It sounds like it's just a nightmare call, but it's not completely their fault. It's Comcast's fault. Let's tell the truth here. 8888-ASK-LEO. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Normally, Chris Marquardt, our photo guy, joins us at this hour, but Chris has the day off, and we thought we'd talk to his buddy, John Miller. John is a podcaster, does a great podcast called The Rest of Everest at therestofeverest.com. Goes every year up to Everest with Chris. They have a photo workshop they do up there, and he's on the line right now with us to talk about the latest footage you brought back. Mm-hmm. Now, you don't go up to K2. You don't go up to the highest peak, do you? John?
Well, Everest is the highest peak, but no, K2 is in Pakistan.
What am I saying? Everest is higher than... I thought K2 was Everest, so it's not. Everest is the highest peak.
Yep, two different. Okay. We go up to the bottom of the top.
You go to base camp.
We go to base camp, yeah.
How high is that?
17,500, 17,600 feet, depending on your source.
That's high enough. Mm-hmm. And you'd think he'd be high enough, but no. You decided to take it a little bit higher. Tell us about that.
Well, every time I go out there, I try to document the experience a little bit differently. First, went out there shooting standard def video. 2007, switched to HD. 2010, did 3D, which looked cool, but only about six people watched it that way. So this time I decided I was really getting into looking what else to do, and I kind of came across the DJI Phantom.
These are those quadcopter. Photographers love these. We have one, and photographers love them because they're remote control, you know, flying things. They have four propellers, but the chief advantage is a very stable platform.
Very stable, very easy to fly. And so I did a bunch of research, and it just didn't seem like the Phantom was going to be large enough to carry the payload I wanted. I want to take a much larger camera. Normally you fly a GoPro.
Right.
And it just didn't seem like these would fly at that altitude.
That's another issue, isn't it? It's 17,000 feet. The air's thinner. You don't have as much lift.
It's lift, yeah. So I want a much larger quadcopter. However, I did take my Phantom up to base camp, and I flew it. And there's a video on my YouTube channel where you can actually see there's the proof that I actually flew the Phantom at base camp.
So it will fly.
And you're showing footage of my aerials video for those of you watching live. There are a couple of shots from the Phantom at Everest Base Camp.
But this is a different one. What is the drone that you're using for?
The one I have is built by a company called Turbo Ace, sold by a company called Wow Hobbies out of Southern California. It's the Matrix.
And is it a bigger wingspan? Is that why it's got more lift? Or
it's a completely different animal than the Phantom. It uses 15-inch propellers instead of 9-inch propellers.
Holy cow.
And so you can have a much larger payload. You know, I'm not disparaging the Phantom at all. I love my Phantom, but it just didn't have enough lift to carry anything other than a GoPro.
And then what kind of camera did you attach? Because these are the crystal clear HD video.
Yeah, this is a Sony NEX-5.
Love that.
A current generation Sony NEX-5. Yeah. And so the APS-C sensor is so much better than a GoPro. I love the GoPro, but having a real sensor, much larger sensor, it makes all the difference.
And what kind of lens did you put on here?
This is just the kit lens. The gimbal that I have, I can actually show you here. The gimbal here is the Matrix. I'm up at my cottage in Maine on vacation right now. But I brought
your quadcopter. You never should be. A man should never be without his quadcopter.
So here is the gimbal. The gimbal is what stabilizes the camera, makes it nice and silky smooth. Think of it like a Steadicam for your camera. But the gimbal is very sensitive to balance. And so you have to make sure that your camera is balanced properly for it to function and smooth everything out. And it was balanced for the kit lens with the Sony NEX-5, which is an 18 to 70.
What did you set it for? Because obviously you can't zoom while you're in the air.
Oh, you go as wide as the lens will go.
So you were 18 millimeters, which is a nice wide angle.
Or maybe it's a 16. You know, it's just been so long since I've looked at the specs of it. But I think it was like a 24 millimeter, 35 millimeter equivalent.
That's nice. Yeah,
which is, you don't get any fisheye, which is really nice.
No curvature. It's all, but you can see a lot of the hill and a lot of the landscape.
You can see a lot. And I just, you know, for these, I just throw it on autofocus and it focuses out to infinity for the most part. So
Worried about losing it?
You know, I was worried about losing it. You're always worried a little bit.
If it goes down up there, you're not going to go get it.
No, that's the thing. That's the problem. That's what I was most worried about. My Sherpa staff would go get it no matter where it crashed. And I knew that. And I knew that they would probably put themselves in danger. And so these guys are machines, and they were so enthusiastic. They were just thinking it was the coolest thing ever.
They've
so
never seen anything like it, I'm sure, right?
No one really had.
Yeah.
And especially Chris Marquardt and I decided to go into a different area on the way to base camp, which gets much less traffic. So, the people in the Tame Valley and the Gokyo Valley, this was the first time anyone had seen anything like this.
It is gorgeous footage. You can see it on YouTube if you go to youtube.com/TheRestOfEverest. In fact, John's got a lot of great stuff up there about the expeditions. I know you lead workshops every year that people just, every time people come back from these, they're raving about.
Yeah, and Leo, I have to say thank you because about half the people on our workshops only know about us because of the tech guy.
Oh, we're sending lots of people up into the hills.
Yeah,
so I wouldn't want to summit Everest, but I think I could make it to base camp. What do you do to prepare for that? Because it's still pretty high.
Well, you know, you just have to be in decent shape.
Oh, that rules me out.
You don't, No. Certainly not. It's mostly mental, and so you just have to be okay, kind of going to the bathroom in a hole in the ground.
I can live with that. And do you bring oxygen up there that high, or?
No, you don't need it. You don't need it. You might think you need it, but no, you don't need it.
It's kind of a challenge for photographers because I don't know. I would look at this and say, well, what can I take that hasn't been taken? It is perhaps the most recorded natural wonder ever, right? Everybody's taken these pictures.
That was Chris Marquardt's biggest concern on this trip was that he'd be getting the same shots he got in previous trips. But each trip is different. Each trip is a phenomenal experience. It's a life-changing experience every time you go out there, even if you've been out. This is my seventh time to Everest, and it's a unique place, and
a great
it's very,
place
very
for
special.
Photographers. Do you mostly shoot video, or do you also shoot some stills while you're up there? I know Chris does mostly stills.
My joke is that I do understand technically that my 5D Mark III can take photos, but no, I almost always just shoot video.
But you know, you get great video with these modern cameras. Now the Sony NEX5. Is a very nice kind of entry level camera. I gave my son one for his high school graduation. He loves taking pictures with it. And the video, you forget, but you've got a high def video camera in your pocket there.
You know, if you look at that aerials video on my YouTube channel,
it's spectacular.
About 90% of it is shot with the NEX5. I had the Mark III with me, but it was just too large for what I wanted to shoot.
This feels like IMAX quality. It's just mind-boggling.
I've been really pleased with the results.
Now, it's on a gimbal, so you're able to aim the camera. You're able to move the camera around as you're flying the plane. Is that right?
Yeah, I can with the gimbal that I have, I can move the camera to point straight at the horizon to 9 degrees straight down. So it can be looking straight down if necessary, anywhere in between.
Wow.
And so you get a lot of flexibility.
Don't look at this footage if you're afraid of heights. Because it's 17,000 plus. How high did it go above a ground level?
Oh, you know, I don't have the exact.
A few hundred feet.
I probably went, 300-400 feet at maximum. But you really didn't need to go much higher than that to get the perspective.
You feel like you're pretty high to begin with in the mountains, and then you just go.
Yeah,
the one
pass was almost 17,800 feet.
Wow.
Just ground level. So. Yeah, it was really special.
Are you a professional photographer, John? Is that your business?
I'm a professional videographer, yeah.
Videographer, yeah. John Miller, therestofeverest.com, and of course on YouTube as well. And if you haven't seen the footage, it was a big viral hit. I think you got more than 1 million views. Just worth seeing. Go to YouTube and look at it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number. You can tell musical director Nathan Staden is in the cockpit there, steering the musical portion of this program here. Joe is on the line from Austin, Texas. Hey, Joe, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello, Leo.
Hey, how are you?
Well, pretty good, sir. How about yourself?
Very well, Joe. What can I do for you?
Well, I about a month ago, got an Amazon Fire TV.
Oh, yeah.
And I've hooked it up to my TV, hooked it up directly to the TV on the HDMI output. It works perfectly.
Mm.
However, when I try to plug it through my Denon AV receiver, I don't get anything. And I'm wondering, is there a solution to that?
You know, I have a Denon AV receiver. I think they're very good. Been very happy about that. And the idea, one of the reasons you use an AV receiver is because you have more AV stuff to attach to your TV than your TV has HDMI ports for. So the Denon I use, I think it has 7 HDMI ports, and then I connect that to the TV, and that way I just choose on the AV receiver what I want to watch. I have not yet. I have a Fire TV. I haven't plugged it in, but I can't imagine why it wouldn't work.
I'm just wondering, is it one of those protection, HDMI protection things?
Yeah, no, because everything along that chain is what they call HDCP compliant. HDCP, I'm not sure what it stands for. I always think of it as high def copy protection, because that's what it is.
That's true.
Yeah, it requires that everything be compliant, including the cable, the TV, and that's so that you can, that's just annoying, but it's just so that you can't copy the movie. And so you're right. The first thing, if I have trouble on an HDMI chain, the first thing I think of is, well, maybe it's that. But, you know, everything on that, you're using the same cable.
Yeah.
You're using the same TV. The Denon is HDCP compliant. I can't imagine. And anyway, even if it is HDCP, usually the result is it lowers the resolution but still plays.
Okay.
So I don't think that's the issue. I would look at the cables, make sure you have the right cable. Have you tried other ports?
You know, I actually tried another port today, and I ended up with the same result. But what I was
that's a head scratcher.
But when I plugged it into the, well, actually, I plugged it into another TV. I've got a 32-inch Samsung, and when I plugged it into the Samsung directly, it worked perfectly.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, okay, so I know
we know the fire's working. It could be a resolution thing. Now, sometimes this happens to me, and it is, you know, kind of a problem in general, which is the TV is expecting a certain resolution, certain frame rate, and it has to adjust as it gets the stuff. It may be that for some reason, I mean, I would look at the settings in the Fire TV, make sure you're sending 1080i content.
Oh, I gotcha.
Yeah. Just to make sure. I can't think of why it wouldn't work. It's that we call this handshake, where the TV says, well, what resolution are you sending? What am I going to get from you? You're going to get 1080i 60 frames, or you're going to get 1080p 60 frames. And then the TV, you might even see, sometimes will pop up, okay, I'm on HDMI 1 and I'm seeing 1080p 60p. So make sure that, and sometimes the handshake fails, and then it wouldn't display. It would do exactly what it's doing, which is it wouldn't display anything.
Gotcha.
But usually this isn't a problem, so I'm just puzzled. You might, Omega Project in our chat room is suggesting a good troubleshooting thing to do if you have handshake issues, which is turn everything off, unplug everything, plug it all in, and one by one plug it in. So plug in the Denon, then plug in the Fire TV, make sure their handshaking is working. Now turn on the TV, and in other words, don't try to, you know, try to kind of get them all to kind of talk to each other before they try to display. And do make sure, yeah, and do make sure you use well, I presume you're, I mean, HDMI is HDMI. I don't
Right.
Unless it's a bad cable, I don't see why there'd be any issue.
Well, as I say, I used the same cable when I hooked it up to the smaller TV,
yeah,
and
it's
it
weird.
Worked perfect.
And your Denon's working fine with other inputs. Your Blu-ray plays fine and everything, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Sounds like a handshake. It's the only thing I can think of is handshake, and that's always a little funky, and it requires turning things off and on and getting them to say, hey, wake up, I'm 60p. Oh, well, let's try that. And then things will work. I love the. Do you like the Fire TV? Have you had much chance to use it?
I have. In fact, I've been using it a lot for. I've used it both for Netflix and Amazon Prime, and it's a sweet product.
For $99, it's basically like a Roku or an Apple TV, but it has some nice features. It has a speech feature. You could talk into the remote and find stuff. Unfortunately, you only find stuff on Amazon right now, and I hope they fix that.
Yeah, I've already used that. That's great.
It is. It's very smart. It also has games, and that's one of the things that's unique about it. You can play Android games on the thing. Have you tried that at all?
I haven't. I'm not a gamer, but you've just planted an idea.
It's fun. It's fun. Well, good luck. You know, they even sell a console-style controller for gaming on the Fire TV.
You're kidding. Really?
Yeah. I have the whole setup, and I just haven't hooked it up. You know what? I'm going to hook it up on my Denon tonight and see how that works.
Good enough. I'll be watching you next week.
Yeah, if I have a problem, I'll let you know, Joe.
Thanks a lot,
yeah.
Leo.
Seems unusual. I think that's the kind of thing that's just, you know, keep plugging and unplugging and turning it on and turning it off, and eventually they should work just fine. Bob in that was Bob in Laguna Niguel. Well, Bob in Laguna Niguel is on now. You're going to Africa? Hello, Bob. Hey, Bob. Hey, Bobby. Now, let me just, is there a smudge on my microphone? Bob in Laguna Niguel, are you there? Oh, shoot. Well, I'll tell you what, I'll put him on hold, Heather, and if we can get him back, we will. But, oh, here he comes. He's running over to the phone. Hey,
hello.
Bob. Hey. That's okay, I understand. You've been on hold for an hour. You probably had to, you know, do something else. That's fine. Welcome back. You're going to Africa.
I am going to Africa in September, and we have a Canon PowerShot SX200IS.
Nice camera. Keep it in your pocket, but if you want to get shots of lions on your safari, you're going to need something more than that.
That's why I'm calling.
Yeah. I love those Canon power shots. I think, in fact, many pros carry them around just because it's good to have a camera in your pocket at all times. And you don't want to bring a big system around with you. If you're will, how much, you have a budget?
Not really. We, you know, this is going to be probably once in a lifetime. I'd like to get something that's decent, but we're kind of old and slow, so I don't need anything too complicated. So if I could find something simple, that's what I'm looking for.
What you don't want is a slow camera because, of course, the minute you see that elephant, you want it's going to move. So you want to be able to pull the camera up to your eye and take that shot. So you want fast focus. You're right. You want an easy camera. You don't want a camera you have to fiddle with knobs and buttons and dials to get it to work. Somebody in the chat room, Minnesota Mac, is suggesting, and I agree with him, the Sony Alpha cameras. They're great. In this case, he likes the A6000. Sony, these are high-quality interchangeable lens cameras. They start at $700, so they're not super expensive, but they have great sensors. In fact, it's the camera that our guy John Miller was just talking about that he put up on the drone. The video is spectacular, so you'll get great stills, great video. Sony's been doing a marvelous job. Highly recommend it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. 8888-ASK-LEO, that's the phone number. We talk about tech each and every week at this time, and I'm glad you're here. We were talking with Bob. He's going to Africa. That's exciting. And, of course, Heather Hummond was in Africa 6 months ago, something like that. Not too long ago.
4 months ago.
Yeah, recently. You did not bring a fancy camera with you.
I didn't.
Why not?
Because I can't be entrusted with nice things.
Sometimes I think having, being the photographer takes you away from the stuff. And I have to say, when we were in Hawaii, while I did bring a very nice camera with me, I often didn't take it out because I wanted to enjoy what I was seeing, right?
Savor the moment, yeah.
But if you're going once in your lifetime, you're going to Africa, it's nice to have a good camera. If you're going with your spouse, you can, have her hold the camera sometimes and you hold the camera sometimes. And that way you could take turns and so forth. So we were talking about what camera to bring, and a couple of things I would say. One, you want one with fast focus, one that's easy enough to use that you can just bring it to your eye and shoot. That means fast turn on, fast focus speed. You probably want a couple of lenses. It could be a zoom lens that does this, but you want one for wide angles because when you're on the Serengeti and you want to be able to see the vast scope of the gazelle herd, a wide angle lens, something like 24 millimeters, is going to help get the whole thing. But you're also going to want a telephoto. You were saying that while the giraffes and elephants might come right up to you, the cheetahs don't come close. They're off in the trees in the distance, right?
Exactly.
So having a long lens that you can pick that up might help. And I would say 200 would be... Now we're starting to get in a pretty fancy kit. I'm a big fan of a few of these mirrorless cameras because they're lighter, they're fast, they're fairly easy to use, but they still get excellent imagery. Now, there's really two kinds of mirrorless cameras. There's the Micro Four Thirds system, and I've been a big fan of that. My favorite Micro Four Thirds camera is from Olympus. It's the OMD-EM1. I'm sorry, the EM5. No, the M1. The M1's the most recent one. That's a beautiful camera. Pricey. You're going to spend over $1,000 when you get the camera and a lens. But they do have the advantage of Micro Four Thirds is a huge variety of very good quality lenses. So you have a nice choice. You can get a zoom, single lens zoom, on a OMD that'll go from like 16 millimeters to 200 millimeters or even wider, I think, or longer. So you can get one lens that will do it all. And that's probably the best thing. You know, that's the other thing you don't want to be doing is switching lenses in the middle of the desert, or on the plains there and getting dust in the lens and everything. But we did mention the Sonys, and I think Sony is really starting to creep into the lead in terms of cameras, especially mirrorless. They don't make Micro Four Thirds mirrorless cameras. They make cameras with even bigger sensors. And a bigger sensor is better in general. They use APS-C sized sensors, which are bigger than Micro Four Thirds, a little smaller than the full frame sensor cameras like the Nikon and the Canons that a lot of pros use. Although Sony's latest, the A7R, uses a and the A7S uses a full frame sensor, so that's pretty nice to have the mirrorless camera, which means it's lighter and simpler, maybe even a little faster, and also have these really high quality sensors, amazing lenses. That's a nice combination. So the Sony NEX line, the Sony Alpha line, and now they've renamed, I don't know what they call it now, but the A7, these are really excellent cameras. The A6000 would be a good choice. I gave my son for his, as I mentioned, for his graduation, a Sony NEX. I think I gave him a 6. There's 4, 5, 6. And these are just spectacular images that you're getting out of these. I've really been very happy with what Sony's up to. Of course, there are many, many good choices. You can go to a site like dpreview.com and go crazy. Look at cameras and lenses to your heart's content. And in some respects, there isn't a wrong choice to make because it's not the camera. It's the photographer. It's the opportunity. It's being there and having a decent camera will make the difference. But I would say simple is good, not too finicky. Some of the Sony A7 is a little finicky, a little weird. The OMD EM1, very easy to use, very fast, lots of nice features. There's so many good choices out there. I think the good news is digital photography has really reached its matured. I don't want to say peak because that implies it can't go any higher. In fact, I think we're only going to get better. But it's to the point now where it is absolutely as good as, if not better than, film. So have a great trip, Bob. Lots of good choices out there. I do agree the Sony A6000 is an excellent choice at a good price, about $800 bucks. Aaron in Tustin, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, Leo. How are you?
Oh, yeah. Bring extra batteries, by the way. you don't want a dead battery to stop you from getting that shot of the cheetah. I am great, Aaron. How are you?
I'm doing well. Say, I had a question. So like a lot of companies, my companies, you know, shut down our, you know, corporate office, or just, you know, our local office, and so we're all working from home. And of course, I brought home one of these massive, kind of hulking, you know, laser jet printers. And you know, it's really an eyesore. It's really ugly, and I think it's just too big to have in my home office. So I'd like to put it somewhere else in the house, like downstairs in the garage, you know, out of the way.
Well, this is one of the reasons I love these new network printers, because you can, especially if you have Wi-Fi, it doesn't have to be anywhere near the computer. Older printers, they plug into the computer, and of course that means it has to be right next to you.
Yeah, this is, you know, it's one of those office printers, so it only has a network jack to go into it, but you know, you have to run an Ethernet cable, and so I don't think it's easy run an Ethernet cable.
No Wi-Fi, huh? Yeah.
Yeah. And so my question is, what do you think is the easiest way to, I guess, hook that up to my router upstairs? Now, I looked at a couple options. You know, you can do like, I was thinking of getting like a, you know, a second wireless access point or like an extender. I'm not sure which one of those. As well as I've heard of like, you know, you can network through the power line or the phone line or even the cable line in your house, which, you know, is already, you know, set up through the house.
That's kind of a pain. I would go to Lantronics, Lantronix.com. They make devices around $150 that will plug into your printer, USB or Ethernet, and turn it into a wireless printer. They have the one advantage. Their printers are designed to they have two different print servers. One is for iOS, so it supports AirPrint. If you're printing from an iPhone or iPad, that's very handy. The other is designed to work with Google Cloud Print, which I recommend because then not only can you print over Wi-Fi to your printer in the basement of the garage, but you can print on the road because Google Cloud Print is kind of cool. It lets you print anywhere you're online to your printer at home. So I think this is a pretty good choice. I don't think wireless phone line networking or power line networking at this point. I like Lantronics. It's going to be less expensive. It's purpose-built. It's designed for the printer. And it just basically turns any printer into a wireless printer.
Do you know about getting like a second router or a wireless extender? Access point.
So you don't have Wi-Fi where you want to put it?
No, there is Wi-Fi. But like I said, there's no, you know, it's a matter of getting the printer to be wireless.
Yeah, so this plugs it. So what you do, you plug plug the printer into the power, plug this into the printer. As long as the Lantronics can see the Wi-Fi, so in your garage or basement there is Wi-Fi access, it's now a Wi-Fi printer.
Oh, okay. I see you've got one right there.
I'm holding one up. And look, you can see it on the radio right now. there are a lot of other choices it'll do this. If you wanted internet access for other things in your garage, then you might look at power line networking. It certainly works. But you have to have an adapter upstairs. You have to have an adapter downstairs. If there are any junction boxes between the two, you know, a fuse box or something, if they're on separate, in effect, separate grids, it isn't going to work. It doesn't go jump across those. I like the idea of getting that existing laser printer on the wireless network. It's just going to be more flexible. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 88-ask Leo. That's the phone number. We're going to take another call here. Paul's next in Stevensville, Montana. Hello, Paul. Leo Laporte here.
Hi, Leo. Finally glad to get through to you.
Yeah, sorry to keep you on hold so long.
No problem. I've got a problem with my Ivy Bridge Intel system with gadgets. I use three-day gadgets, an MSN weather gadget, a network meter, and a CPU meter. And I've been using all of these systems I've been building for many years. And all of a sudden, on one system, when it boots up, the gadgets don't come up.
You know, Microsoft stopped doing gadgets.
Huh?
Microsoft discontinued gadgets, probably for this reason. You're on Windows 7?
Yeah, Windows 7 Professional.
Yeah. I just went to a Microsoft site. It says, gadgets have been discontinued. Apps do more and are more secure. So stop using gadgets.
Well, I didn't know that.
Well, you know, gadgets are no longer available on our website because the Windows Sidebar platform and Windows 7 and Windows Vista has serious vulnerabilities. This is on Microsoft's own site. They say this. Microsoft
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they've retired the feature in newer releases of Windows. Now, this is not to say that I like those gadgets, too. That's one of the reasons I liked Windows 7. But apparently there are flaws in the gadgets, that's not why yours are stopped working. But maybe something to keep in mind that going forward, if you can replace gadgets with something else, you might get better results. Why are his gadgets gone, though? That's the question. I mean, even though Microsoft didn't put them in Windows 8 and they don't support them anymore, I don't think they turned them off in Windows 7. I think they're still there.
No, they're still working on other systems.
Yeah.
I've got three or
four
different computers. Also, you had a caller earlier who had a problem with updates that wouldn't install.
Yeah.
And I've had one update on here that failed to install over 300 times. And in the course of... You know what
the definition of insanity is? Doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. I think it's 300 times. It's time to say, okay, that's not going to work.
Well, that was MSN's doing, not mine.
Oh, don't use MSN. You're using MSN too, huh?
Yeah, unfortunately.
Did you update? Actually, maybe they did kill gadgets. Did you update to IE11 on that version of Windows 7?
Yeah, on this one I did, IE11.
Bingo.
My wife's computer won't run anything higher than IE10, although she's using the same operating system on another Intel motherboard.
So apparently the update to IE11 kills the gadgets.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Thank you, Microsoft.
Oh, great.
This is why people don't run updates, because they get unexpected side effects. Yeah, Microsoft really doesn't want you to use gadgets. So your reason your wife's computer's gadgets are still working is because she can't update to 11. However, I got to tell you, that's not necessarily a good thing, because you do want to get the latest version of IE always. There are almost always flaws in earlier versions. 10, I don't think 10 was too bad, but you certainly don't want to go back any farther on IE. My suggestion would be don't update on her system. Have her use a different browser like Chrome. And let me see here if I can find a link to how to get the gadgets back. Because apparently this is something that I didn't know about, but when you update to IE11, the gadgets go away. And apparently Microsoft has not. That was intended. There's a workaround that may work for you. Involves resetting the Zoom DPI setting. What? What? That can't be right. Apparently that's the fix. I'll tell you what. I'll put the there's an article here that the chat room gave me from InfoWorld that talks about how, the workaround, how to get it, why it happened. We'll put that in the show notes, and I'll leave it to you to do it. TechGuyLabs.com. But I got to tell you, you want to get that update thing fixed, and when you're there getting the link to how to get the gadgets back, you might want to make sure you're getting your updates. Because basically, that machine now is a sitting duck. It's because it's not getting updated. I don't want to say anything, but lots of people shouldn't be using Windows. Windows is for business. Don't use the Windows at home. It's a dangerous thing, unless you know what you're doing. If you're going to keep using Windows, you've got to kind of become a security expert. That's the fact of it. David in Northridge, California. I think Windows is designed for companies that have IT departments that can do that for you. Hi, David. What can I do for you?
Yeah. Hey, Leo. So, I want to know if you could give me a good recommendation for, like, tracking your phone on Google Play, like buying or free.
Yeah. Google makes something. They've just put out for tracking your phone. It's what's it called? I got to remember it. I installed it. It comes on many newer Android phones, but you can get it download it directly from the Play Store. And let me just look real quickly because I have it on all my phones. What it'll do? You want, I presume, something that will, if you lose your phone, let you know where it is, but will also lock it if you can't find it. That kind of thing.
It sounds perfect.
Yeah. Yeah, what's the name of that Google... Android Device Manager. Thank you. Chat room knew it. So search the Play Store for the Android Device Manager. It's free. It's from Google. It's the kind of thing, really, that should be coming on all phones, and I imagine in future it will be. This is the somewhat controversial kill switch that many people have said that the phone companies, you know, the wireless companies, should put on your Android device, but they don't. And apparently these companies don't want to do it because there's a brisk market in Android phones, and they like the idea. For whatever reason, I'm not sure why they don't want kill switches, but you can use the Android Device Manager. It comes from Google, and it will give you a kill switch. You know, another good choice, somebody's reminding me, is Lookout, which is a free app that you can download that will scan for viruses. I like Lookout a lot, and it has also a built-in Track My Phone. But I think the Android Device Manager is more complete. It's very much like the Find My iPhone feature on the Apple phone. It'll tell you where the last place it saw the phone was. If you can't find the phone, it'll wipe it for you. I think that's a good feature. Every phone should have that. Free Android Device Manager. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I don't want to offend anybody, so I have to say this carefully. But in general, we've been sold, really the fault is not ours. The fault is the computer industry's. We've been sold a little bit of a bill of goods, and I think it's especially true of Microsoft Windows. These things aren't that easy to use. It's really easy to get yourself into trouble, whether it's viruses, malware, spyware, or just lost data and so forth. It's very easy. And in general, they're more than most of us need to do the things we want to do. Most of the time, most people just want to do email and surf the web, maybe run some simple applications, but we don't need the complexity of Windows. Or, for that matter, in many cases, we don't need the complexity of a Macintosh either. Macintosh, at least, isn't as prone to getting infections. That's a good thing. But it's most users are going to face it and go, what? I don't get it. And it's one of the reasons I think that the iPad has been so successful, and now smartphones too. The level of complexity is lower. The risk of getting into trouble is lower. We store our data in the cloud now a lot of times, so we don't have to worry so much about accidentally deleting or losing something. I think in many cases, stuff is over complex. And the computer industry has always said, oh, no, this is easy. Any kid could do this. And it's true. Any kid can. It's just the normal people who have a hard time using it. So when we were talking earlier to the gentleman who's having trouble with his Windows machine, I think Windows may not be the right choice for a lot of home users, especially. Take a look at the tablets. Take a look at the iPad. If your needs are simple, if it's just surfing an email, an iPad's plenty. If you want to run some applications, maybe look at a Macintosh. But I think home users, Windows is really not designed for home users, despite all the advertising Microsoft does. I feel like it's not. That's my personal belief, and you can take it with a grain of salt if you choose. But boy, if you listen to the show for a while, you kind of start to hear what kind of trouble people can get themselves into with Windows. It's so easy. Tim in Orange, California, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Leo. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I have a question for you. It's about a Samsung Galaxy tablet.
Hmm.
Yeah, I purchased it a couple months ago, and recently, a couple weeks ago, it started acting up to the point where my charge cable wouldn't attach in fully. Ugh. And it wouldn't hold a charge.
Does the Samsung tablet use a standard USB micro charger, or does it have its proprietary charger?
It uses a micro USB charger.
Yeah.
But I did notice. I also have a Galaxy S4 phone.
Yeah.
I tried using the same charger, the one that came for the phone, with the tablet, and it would light up like it was taking power, but it wouldn't take enough to charge.
Yeah. So you're saying that the charger that came with it is not staying in or is not connecting properly?
At first it was, but then it started getting abnormally loose.
Okay. And then you're saying when I use a different micro USB charger, like the one with my S4, that one seats properly, but doesn't charge it very fast.
No, it doesn't charge at all. It will say it's charging, but it'll go.
So you have two different, but you have two different problems here. So the good news is that the connector on the phone, on the tablet, is not damaged. These, unfortunately, are fairly easy to bend and damage. And if that were the case, then every connector, every micro USB power charger would fall out. But only the one that came with it does. So that sounds like the one that came with it is damaged, the charger itself, not the connector on the tablet. That's good news because you can just get a second charger. The issue with the phone charger, it's not providing enough wattage to charge that bigger device. So you'll need to get a micro USB charger. You probably have some. I mean, gosh, this has become such a standard. It's one of the reasons I'm glad that Samsung and others use this. You don't have to use a proprietary charger, which means you don't have to go out and buy an expensive charger. You could just use any old micro USB charger, go down to Radio Shack or whatever. But what I want you to do is get one with a minimum of 10 watts. Now, how do you figure out how much wattage there is? Well, on every charger, you'll see it's in tiny print. You might even need a magnifying glass. But you'll see two values. You'll see the voltage the charger draws, and you'll see the amperage that the charger draws. And a little math fact, watts equals volts times amp. So almost all USB chargers are 5 volts. A few now are 5.2 or more, but typically 5 volts. So you want one that is a 2-amp charger. That'll give you 10 watts total. If you get 5.2 by 2.2, even better. The more wattage, the better, because your tablet needs more wattage to charge. This is true of the iPad as well. You can charge it sometimes on a lesser charger, but it'll take a really long time, or it might not see it at all. Usually the iPad will you'll get a message popping up saying, there's not enough juice coming in here. I can't charge. So my suggestion is, the good news, doesn't sound like your Samsung tablet port is damaged, just the cable that came with it. Either get a new cable if it's removable from the box that plugs into the wall, or if the thing that plugs into the wall is attached to the cable, then get a whole new one. You don't have to get a Samsung brand. In fact, what I would do is look at the Samsung charger, see what voltage and wattage voltage and amperage it has, probably 5 by 2, which is 10 watts, and get something at least that much or better. It's okay to go higher, not so good to go lower, okay? And you'll see, by the way, on chargers for laptops and others, that it's a different story entirely. Usually the voltage is much higher. The total wattage is 30 or more watts. That they don't ever use USB connectors for that one, just because that wouldn't be a good thing for your phone. 5 volts, 2 watts should charge your tablet, no problem at all. Simon in Gardena, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Simon.
Hello.
Leo.
Yes, sir.
Oh, hi. This is David Riverside.
Oh, all right. I'll talk to you, David. How you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
I'll catch you next, Simon.
With you.
Well, welcome. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, long-time listener, first-time caller.
Well, you finally had a problem big enough to call the tech guy.
You know what, Leo, I've had plenty in the past, but just never got around to calling.
Well, I'm glad you called.
Yeah, thank you. So my wife and I, we finally made the transition. We bought a Mac yesterday, the 21.5-inch.
Good man.
Yeah. I'm a longtime desktop Windows user, and she's been trying to talk me into it for a long time. We finally made the purchase yesterday. But I'm looking for an external drive that will read and write Blu-ray.
Oh, dear.
Because I do a lot of video photo albums with all the pictures that I take.
Why do you do Blu-ray? Don't you just want to do DVD? You want to do Blu-ray, really?
Well, you know what? DVD would be fine, and I guess I'm just probably just a little spoiled because I got a nice 55-inch LED.
Apple's always avoided Blu-ray. They do not ship any products with Blu-ray drives because Steve
really?
Jobs called Blu-ray a bag of hurt. It is, not because there's anything wrong with the Blu-ray format, but because the motion picture industry is so paranoid that they've encumbered Blu-ray with all sorts of stuff that make it very hard to implement in the operating system. For instance, you're not allowed to make an operating system that can play back Blu-ray unless you can prove that the operating system itself is secure from piracy. And Steve didn't want to do that. He said, I'm not going to change my whole operating system, burden it with a lot of software to prevent piracy. That's ridiculous. So while you can get a Blu-ray drive, you're not going to be able to burn movies with it. Let's take a break and I'll tell you more. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. So David in Riverside has a brand new iMac that his wife convinced him to buy, but he still wants to burn those Blu-rays. Now, you're not burning commercial movies. You're burning your own images, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I just take we go camping. I take my photos and I use a program and I just put them in with transitions and some background music. And
I mean, the nice thing about that is you've got a ton of space.
Uh-huh.
Probably more. I bet you never fill that disc up, do you?
Never. No.
No. Well, you can get, in fact, absolutely can get, as long as, you know, the trick is that if you wanted to play back Blu-ray movies on your Mac, good luck. Because the copy protection is going to say, wait a minute, that Mac is not HDCP, I'm not going to play back. But if all you want is a burner, no problem. In fact, my suggestion was to, my favorite place to buy stuff for Macintosh is MacSales.com. It's Otherworld Computing. They focus on Mac. So they have, it's one advantage is if they sell something there for your Mac, you know it will work on a Mac. And they have their own Mercury brand Blu-ray player. I'm sorry. $80. And it burns 6X Blu-ray. That's pretty fast. It also does DVD, CD, you know, all the lower formats. So this is one external drive. It's bus power. That means you don't have to plug it into the wall. Just plug it into the USB port on your Macintosh. So I think something like that's fine. They even have an article on their website at MacSales.com. We'll put a link in there on how to burn your HD movies to Blu-ray. The key on this, of course, is you're going to strip out the copy protection because if you have copy protection, it won't play back. So that was the only caveat I wanted to issue, was unlike many Windows machines which come with Blu-ray players, you can put a Blu-ray movie, a commercial Blu-ray disc in there, and play it. It'll work. That won't happen on a Macintosh, only because Apple has consistently decided not to put in the specialized security that would be required by the movie industry, basically. Now, I may be out of date, because let me see. There's an article here. Blu-ray playback comes to OS X. Let me take a look at this. The chat room has provided me with this. I see. It's an additional piece of software that lets you do it. All right. Well, there you go. It's called Mac Blu-ray Player. I have not tried it. I will have to try it and verify that you can do it. Truth is now, Blu-ray, it used to be a Blu-ray player for your home theater was expensive. They're cheap now. They come on the new Xbox One, the Sony PlayStation. So it's not so hard to get Blu-ray. And I think that physical media is kind of old hat now anyway, isn't it? Aren't most of us watching movies streaming and not getting the discs? I think it's probably not worth a lot of effort to try to get those discs playing back on a Mac, unless you have a whole big library. Simon's in Gardena, California. Hi, Simon. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Thanks for being patient.
Hello.
Hey, welcome.
How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Very good. I've been waiting for a long time.
I am so sorry. You're very patient. I appreciate it.
Yeah, we are. Yeah, I'm having a problem with the Windows, you know, on the start page when I click on the Internet Explorer. I don't have any, like, menu bar on the top, and I'm trying to install it, but I can't. But on my desk page, I do have the menu bar and all that. Is it normal or?
You're using Windows 8?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there are two different Internet Explorers on Windows 8. Now, the new 8.1 update, I think, changes this. But the original Windows 8, you have what's the tile-based Explorer. That's the one you're probably seeing a tile for when you click that.
Yeah.
It's all down at the bottom. I want to kill Microsoft sometimes. They put all the stuff at the bottom of the screen. And then when you use Desktop Internet Explorer, same machine, you can even have an icon on the tiles for it. It's all at the top. So I think you're just looking at the wrong... You know what you really should do? Update to Windows 8.1. It's a free update. What you should do is run all the Windows updates, get your system up to the latest version of Windows 8.0, and then you go to the Windows Store, you know, where you buy the tiled apps, and you search for Windows 8.1, and you'd update that from the store. And at that point, I believe it eliminates these two different versions of Internet Explorer. It's a nightmare, frankly. As best I can guess from what you've described, that's the issue. It's on one. There's two versions of IE. One of them, the menu and everything's at the bottom. One of them, the menu and everything's at the top. Of course, you can't find it. It doesn't even say, oh, by the way, you're using desktop IE now, so look at the top. Oh, by the way, you're using tile IE, look at the bottom. No wonder Microsoft cannot sell this operating system. And I would expect that a lot of the people getting fired at Microsoft this week had something to do with all that. I'm hoping. I'm just thinking. JR in Carlsbad, California. Hi, JR.
How are you doing, Leo?
I'm great. Welcome. What can I do for you?
Thank you. I have a laptop computer. All of a sudden, one day, the background went black. Totally black. And I know how to you know, put the background back on, and it shows that it's on there, but it's still black.
Do you see any icons or anything?
Oh, yeah, I see the icons.
Oh, it's just the desktop itself is dark.
The desktop itself, right. And what I had to do, I had to install a new desktop. And that one works with the backgrounds. Isn't that weird?
Well, it's just an image, you know, as your desktop. It's just an image. You can choose any image.
Right, but I tried choosing the images, and they show that they're you know.
So you went into Personalize, and you looked at the various different desktops, and you picked one from the picker. Windows 7, Windows 8, what version of Windows?
Windows 7, Home.
So you personalized it, you picked a desktop, and you just see black.
Yeah, it just sees black.
But if you go to a website and you right-click on the image, say, set this as my desktop background, it does it and it stays that way.
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't. Still doesn't.
It doesn't do anything. It just, no matter what background you choose, it's still black.
Do you get a warning saying this version of Windows is not authentic?
No. Oh, no. This is a definitely...
doesn't matter if it really is authentic. Sometimes Microsoft screws up. One of the things they do when you have an unregistered copy of Windows or they can't verify that it's registered is it turns the background black.
Well, but I've had this computer for like 5 or 6 years. I've never done that. And the new desktop is fine. It works perfectly with the background.
What do you mean the new desktop?
Well, I put it, you know, you can put as many desktops as you want on there. I just renamed it and put a new desktop on it. You understand what I mean?
Yeah.
In other words, I created a new desktop for it.
Yeah, and that one works.
And that one works fine.
Sounds like something's corrupted. I'm not sure what's going on. Make sure you do have a genuine copy of Windows. Otherwise, it sounds like your Windows theme is corrupted, and I don't know what to do in that case. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. I'm Leo Laporte. Thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget, the Tech Guy is just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows now on the Twit Netcast Network, and you'll find them all at twit.tv. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPad on iPad Today. You get your daily dose of tech news from Tech News Today and our weekly roundtable show, This Week in Tech. It's all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next time with another great Tech Guy podcast. Thanks for joining me. See you next time.